Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Amplify. I'm one of your hosts, Sam Ashu, and I just want to say welcome back to the podcast. Today, we're going to dive into the April 2024 pediatric emergency medicine article on Brui. But before we do that, as always, I want to remind you that ebmedicine.net is your one-stop shop for all of your CME needs. That's for emergency medicine, pediatric emergency medicine, and urgent care medicine. Regardless of your practice setting, you can find CME, you can find multiple courses, the laceration course, the EKG course, the abscess course, the billing and coding course, and all of the clinical pathways, the interactive clinical pathways, the mobile app, and then, of course, all three journals, emergency medicine practice, pediatric emergency medicine practice, and evidence-based urgent care, all there. You can get them all for one subscription and get all of your CME needs met. And after listening to today's podcast, make sure you go to ebmedicine.net and claim your CME if you're a subscriber. And now, on to the discussion. Welcome back, everyone. It is me, Sam Ashu, and my partner on the other end of the microphone.
Dr. T.R. Eckler, still back. No explanation for why I keep getting allowed to return, but excited to be here.
Always excited to be here. Today, we're talking about the April 2024 article in Pediatric Emergency Medicine Practice on Brief Resolved Unexplained Events, or BRUI for short. I think that Dr. Austin Page and Dr. Cho did an outstanding job with this article. It's been a while since anyone has looked at this literature. I am old enough, perhaps seasoned enough, I shall say, to remember the days when this was called an acute life-threatening event, or ALTI. That's what it was called back in the days of my residency. And that term was coined by the National Institute of Health back in 1986, which I was not in residency in 1986. I just want to put that disclaimer. I'm not that old. But if you are that old and you're listening, that's okay. So that term was coined in 1986, and then it was decided that would just encompassed too many kind of vague things, and we needed a better diagnosis, a better name, so that we could then start to study this as an independent entity. And then the American Academy of Pediatrics coined the term brief resolved unexplained event, or BRUI, in 2016. So that was a practice change. And when they coined that term, they also released evidence-based guidelines as opposed to just consensus guidelines on the diagnosis, which brings us to today. So since 2016, we've been using the term and we've been able to do research on this specific diagnosis using the evidence-based guidelines that were written in 2016. And there have been more studies that have been published since then, trying to either support those guidelines or maybe even tease them out and make them a little bit more nuanced, which brought about this article. So I thought it was very well written.
I think this is a great example of something that we still haven't fully figured this out. And you're getting to watch our science get a little better. We're getting a little better at characterizing it. And it's the great retrospective of like 40 years of us trying to work this out. I like how the term keeps getting better. Because in 86, they were trying to basically replace the term near-miss sudden infant death syndrome, which it's not easy to say, NMSIDS. But when you say it out loud, I'm sure that wasn't reassuring to parents that you're like, well, this is just a near-miss sudden infant death syndrome, but everything's going to be fine.
It's going to be fine.
Like that's not going to fly. When I was in residency, we would call these an ALTI BRUI because we were on the kind of the bubble of the change. And depending on which pediatrics attending you were talking to, some of them wanted to call it a BRUI, some wanted to call it an ALTI. So we just call it an ALTI BRUI, and it was fun.
Yeah, I remember having discussions, I should say, in the middle of the night with my pediatric colleagues as we discussed the diagnosis. And I would call up and say, yeah, this is an ALTI. And they'll say, now, tell me about this. And I'll say, well, you know, mom says this is what happened and turned white, was limp, not breathing, had to get rescue breaths. Oh, come on. This is probably GERD. Were they feeding? No, they weren't feeding. It's like, okay. I actually had one pediatrician, just as a sidebar, one pediatrician tell me, put mom on the phone.
And yes. I said,
okay, great.
So
I walked in the room and I said, ma'am, your pediatrician wants to speak to you on the phone. He's going to ask you a lot of the same questions I asked just to confirm that history. So I'm just going to put him on the phone with you. She goes, okay, yeah. And she read the subtlety in the lines without me having to say anything. So she picks up the phone and the conversation goes like this. Uh-huh, uh-huh, limp. Yes, limp. Nope, limp. Uh-huh, limp. Yeah, white color, huh? Yep, white. Nope, not red, not blue, white. Yeah, not breathing. No, not breathing slowly, not breathing at all. Okay, I'll put him on the phone. Hang on a second. And then she hands me the phone back. He goes, give me a nurse. I'll give some orders. My favorite pediatric conversation. I was like, yeah, I mean, you know, I asked all the questions and I gave you the answers on the phone. All right, so let's talk about the brief resolved unexplained events.
Can I say something important? Because I feel like this is the one-liner of the paper.
Do it.
Brewy is not just a new name for Alty, okay? We have to say that up front. We are on board with the evidence.
Yes.
A retrospective cohort study showed that only one of 78 patients presenting with an Alty would meet criteria for a Brewy. So they're trying to be much more specific and really get to the kids that we really need to be thinking about and getting to the kids that we really need to be working up. And then also excluding the ones that don't meet this criteria so you can say this is or isn't a Brewy. And then you get a sense from looking at the pathway for these, then what you're supposed to do. Because I think this is such, as you said, such a vague and kind of nebulous catch-all for so many different things. It's really about deciding, is this a Brewy or is it not? And then once you've made that decision, then you can kind of change how you're thinking about it. And then is it a high risk or low risk Brewy? And then it can change how your thinking goes. And then you decide how to work it up. And I think that's really good to just get that from this discussion, because that really drives which kids we're trying to work up and which ones we're not. And also which ones we're even thinking about as a Brewy, which is the ones where we're going completely a different direction.
Yeah, I do think that's a great distinction. So if it's not a Brewy, then this does not apply and you go down the pathway for whatever it is that you discovered it was. And if it is a Brewy, then the distinction is just low risk or high risk. And I think they did a good job in actually providing you with objective criteria, because what we had before was mostly subjective based on what observers were seeing at the scene, usually the parents. So the Brewy, the B-R-U-E, stands for brief resolved unexplained event. And table one breaks down the definitions for those. So brief, meaning it has to be less than a minute. Resolved, meaning that the patient has to now have no symptoms, normal vital signs, normal appearance, back to their baseline state of health. Unexplained, meaning unexplained, which is kind of funny that we have to kind of caveat that. But unexplained literally means that you could not find any explainable medical condition that was associated with this episode, like reflux, nasal congestion, some kind of swallowing dysfunction. Did they have a congenital abnormality? Was there trauma? All of those things would push them out of this diagnosis into a different category. It has to be truly unexplained, meaning they have a normal exam. And then event, meaning that they had some kind of color or tone change. So central cyanosis, central pallor, blue, purple, pale coloration of the face and trunk, central mixed obstructive causes like irregular breathing are included, but clearly identifiable as like a separate entity and not like a breath holding spell. Tone changes with crying, choking, gagging, as well as tone changes that are associated with breath holding spells are not included. Those are not unexplained, right? So they have to have no tone, have to be limp, or have to have spasms and be tense that are not related to choking or gagging or crying. And so the change in tone and the change in color is very, very important and typically comes with a change in level of consciousness, their mental status, the lethargic, somnolence, unresponsiveness, and all of that resolves in less than a minute. So it has to be a tone, color, and mental status change with no explanation that has resolved, and the child you're looking at is going to be a normal appearing child, which by definition means that by the time they get to the ED, it's normal. That your entire exam is going to be unremarkable and what you're left with, the history you get from parents in general.
I liked some more of the specifics they gave here, like if you have acrocyanosis, so color changes in the limbs, or perioral cyanosis, or rubor, meaning they got red all of a sudden, those actually are considered more benign and get excluded from giving you a Brewy. And I feel like a lot of parents are like, oh, they turned blue around their mouth. I was really worried about that. So that was another kind of reassuring thing to put in my pocket. And I thought that the point they made about tonic eye deviations, nystagmus, or any seizure activity or infantile spasms also moves you out of Brewy, and now you're more in a seizure kind of workup pathway.
Yeah, exactly. And then once we've settled that the patient meets the criteria for BRUI, and we're now trying to figure out what we need to do and ultimately the disposition, there's really only two categories. Either they're low risk or they're not low risk, aka high risk. And if they're low risk, there is evidence that, and we'll get into that here in just a minute, there is evidence that these patients need essentially nothing and can go home with reassurance. Now, that doesn't mean the conversation is short and you immediately dismiss mom and dad and send them home. We'll get into the nuances of all of that, but it does mean from a medical evaluation standpoint and a workup standpoint, you're not obligated to get any testing or do anything else. If they're not low risk, there is not great literature for what we do in that category. There has been some published since 2016, and that distinction, that low risk versus not low risk, is really based on six factors. First, what's their age? Are they more than 60 days old? If they're less than 60 days old, that's an automatic exclusion. They're not low risk. Second, what's their gestational age and their post-conceptional age? So is their gestational age greater than 32 weeks? And is their post-conceptional age greater than 45 weeks? Third, is this their first BRUI? Have they had a previous BRUI? That's an exclusionary criteria for low risk. Or are they occurring in clusters? Did they have multiple in a short period of time? That's also an exclusion for low risk. Fourth was the event duration less than a minute. Now, that's actually a defining characteristic for BRUI, so just FYI. Fifth, no cardiopulmonary resuscitation by a trained medical provider required. So parents, unless they're trained medical providers, don't satisfy this criteria, meaning that the parent may have been alarmed enough to start CPR or rescue breaths or something of that sort. But if it wasn't continued or found to be necessary by EMS when they arrived, then that's okay. It can still be low risk. And then lastly, no concerning historical or physical exam findings. And we'll get into that here in just a few minutes, the kind of questions you want to ask and the kinds of things you want to look for on exam.
I don't think I've ever asked a parent how long since your child was conceived. So I'm excited to try to work out the language that I'm going to use for like, so how long has it been since your child was conceived before this event? Because that's going to be tricky to work out. I feel like I'm going to need like the old OB like wheels.
When they showed up.
Yeah.
This may seem confusing when we talk about age and gestational age and post-conceptional age. And this phrasing is a little bit foreign, I think, to most of us as emergency physicians. Probably not if you're in pediatric emergency medicine. But for the rest of us, it seems a little foreign. And the rationale behind that is that you can meet the age criteria greater than 60 days, but still not be low risk if you were in that extreme premature age range. So for example, if you were born at 32 weeks and you're now 60 days, you're actually still not low risk because your post-conceptional age hasn't reached 45 weeks yet. So it's just pointing out the not low risk group who was born very prematurely, who hasn't had enough time yet to pass that 45 weeks post-conception age limit. So it's an interesting way to phrase it, and it may seem confusing, but it behooves you to figure out when they were born and how old they are now and add those two things together and also make sure they meet the post-conceptional age criteria. As we get into the guidelines from here, we're going to start talking about low risk and high risk criteria. But I think the authors did a good job of driving home the point that if they're in the low risk criteria group, that's great. All of this applies. If they're in the higher risk criteria group, there are no recommendations from the AAP based on these guidelines. So it's more focused on figuring out who the low-risk people are and how we can get away without doing as much testing and doing less harm to these patients, and less focused on what we do with the high-risk patients. Just like everything else we talk about in medicine, we got to consider a differential diagnosis. And there is a good table, table 4 on page 6, which gives you the differential diagnosis for all BRUI-type events. And it is very broad. So there are 10 different boxes for 10 different systems in the body, each of them with anywhere from 6 to 10 bullet points, anything from cardiovascular abnormalities, arrhythmias, channelopathies, ventricular pre-excitation, to infectious causes like UTI and sepsis and meningitis, to metabolic derangements like hypoglycemia, electrolyte abnormalities, mitochondrial disorders, to non-accidental trauma, to hematologic abnormalities, to GI problems like gastroesophageal reflux disease, esophageal foreign bodies, tracheoesophageal fistulas, bowel obstructions, to toxin exposures, and even some of the what they call the miscellaneous things like acrocyanosis, hypothermia, or just idiopathic. We're not sure, but there's a lot of diagnoses in the differential for a BRUI that you need to consider. That doesn't mean you have to get testing for all of these, but this is the reason why the guidelines exist, because if you can identify a low-risk group of patients, then you don't have to go hunting for the 8,000 things on the list for differential diagnosis, which makes this actually very, very important.
And also, if you can't identify them as low-risk, it's not unreasonable to then consider an admission for this kid to go hunting for some of these things, because it's such a broad differential. It's not something you're going to work out in a couple of hours in the emergency department.
Exactly. Like all of our other conversations, we like to start in the pre-hospital arena. And I think this is one of the topics where our pre-hospital personnel become pretty critical, right? Although the intervention aspect of it may not be significant, meaning as a pre-hospital person, an EMT or a paramedic coming to the scene of a parent who's called you for an event like this, there may not be much you need to do as far as resuscitating the child, because by definition, it's brief and resolved. And it's probably already resolved by the time you get there. It is your observations as the first trained medical person that become critically important. And the article references the components of the pediatric assessment triangle, things that include appearance, work of breathing, and circulation. So noting those three things immediately on arrival in the closest proximity of time to the event is very, very important. And whether or not you as a pre-hospital care person initiate something like CPR or resuscitation also becomes critically important, because by definition, the BRUI is someone who did not require anything of that sort from a trained medical provider. So this is critically important. Also confirming the history that it lasted less than a minute and that it's completely resolved and the parents agree everything's back to baseline now before you arrived in most cases. And the authors drove home the point that the National Model EMS Clinical Guidelines published by the National Association of State EMS officials recommend transporting patients to an appropriate pediatric emergency facility, even if they appear well and have returned to their baseline. Because again, by definition, this diagnosis says they're well appearing and they're back to baseline. And even in some rural areas, the temptation might be, well, everything's okay. It was probably nothing. And there's no reason to transport this patient. And that may be pressure you're getting from the parent in that scenario as the EMS provider. We don't want to go to the hospital. We called you. Everything's better now. This is one of those circumstances where you would say, actually, you need to go and we need to take you somewhere that's appropriate for children to be evaluated. Because by definition, everything has resolved before we got here and more evaluation needs to occur. And so it is a recommendation even by the EMS clinical guidelines that all of these patients get transported, even if they have a completely normal appearance when you arrive.
Yeah, I think having been in rural places, there's times where EMS crews will call you and say, hey, you know, the parents don't really want to come in. Like, can you talk to them for a minute? We'll kind of see if they really need to come. It's really nice to be able to say, look, the national guidelines, AAP, EMS, everyone recommends that if something like this happens, you've got to come in. And if you can rattle off these criteria real quick, or you can pull them up on your phone, you can see if it lasted more than a minute, or if the kid's really young, you can make an even stronger case pretty quickly that like, hey, don't overthink this. This kid needs to come in.
When it comes to initial stabilization, even by our pre-hospital personnel or immediately when they arrive in the emergency department, if they need initial stabilization, it's not a BRUI. And I say that because the definition of BRUI says it was brief and resolved. And if they need some kind of intervention immediately by the EMS personnel or when they arrive in the ED, it's not brief. It hasn't resolved. This person does not fit this category. And that's an important distinction as well, because most of these people are going to come in, they're going to be well appearing. And again, we want to take the diagnosis seriously, because the things that can mimic this and be serious are plentiful on that differential diagnosis list. And you are now charged with trying to figure out if that indeed fits one of those categories. And so keep in mind, if they need resuscitation, they're obviously not in this category. There was a prospective longitudinal cohort study of infants hospitalized with BRUI that showed that 86% of patients had persistent symptoms after discharge reported by caregivers, including 12% who had recurrent bruises and 15% requiring repeat hospital visits. And the conclusion there was even infants with symptoms thought to be resolved required a thorough ED evaluation. So there is data suggesting that getting the definition exactly right is a critically important step, and that's why it's being placed in the hands of the physician in this scenario, or the provider if you're in an ED with no physician, because it needs to go to the person with the highest medical training to say, yes, this was actually a bruise and all the symptoms are actually gone and we're all on the same page. So that's the critical mental key step in all of this. When it comes to the history, this gets a little bit more complicated. Lots and lots of questions to ask, and that honestly can be hard to track. So there is a very good table, table 3 here on page 5 of the article, that walks you through the historical features you got to consider in the evaluation of a patient who you think has experienced a bruise.
I think that this is kind of one of those things where I'm reading it and I just save a picture for my phone, because you're going to rarely see these cases in the emergency room. But when you do, you want to be able to have a standard list of questions or things that you can ask them, or you can go through and pull it up. Or if you're training a student, this is a list that you can give that student and say, hey, go ask all these questions and then see what you get from that. I think, like you said, for the differential, they're so broad in terms of the causes and the things that you need to kind of really start to get like the first early symptoms of, or the early warning signs that something's there. This list of questions really will take you from feeling like you have no idea what could be causing this to really starting to narrow it down. And it gives a great lift to the next person that's going to try to take over this patient and really figure out what happened.
Yeah, honestly, I couldn't say it better. There's a lot of questions to ask here. Some of the data supporting these questions, there was a multi-center retrospective cohort. This was 980 infants who were hospitalized with a bruise after an ED visit. 37% had an explanatory diagnosis identified during their hospitalization. 4% were deemed serious. And the features, the things that they found, were non-accidental trauma was about 0.5 to 11% of these diagnoses. Manifestations of a seizure was about 10% of these cases. And lower respiratory tract infections like RSV and pertussis were some of commonly found diagnoses, about 8% of these patients. So it's important to ask a wide range of questions in multiple categories to try and rein in, is it an actual bruise? And then are they actually low risk? And the types of things that we're looking for, questions about child abuse, things like, are there historical changes? Is the story coming from mom and dad changing each time I go in a little bit? Are there some inconsistencies with the child's developmental stage? So, you know, is this a 2-month-old, they say, just rolled off the bed or rolled off the table and going, a 2-month-old rolling off of a changing table seems unlikely. And then there's history of the event. So the general description, who's reporting, who saw it, having an account from someone who saw the event becomes very, very important. Was the person asleep? Were they awake? Were they supine? Were they prone? Were they feeding? What was the state during the event? Were they choking? Were they moving? Were their eyes open? What was their tone? Were there repetitive movements? Did they appear distressed or alarmed? Or does the child look fine and it was more the parent who was alarmed? Skin color, all of this stuff becomes important because it's in the definition for bruise. Was there any bleeding? What were the color of the lips and then the extremities and the central part of the trunk? What ended the event? Did you have to do something? Did it stop on its own? Did it end abruptly or was it a gradual ending? Did you call 911? And what did they do? And then what happened after the event? Did they go back to normal spontaneously? Was it gradual? Was it pretty sudden recovery? Was there any kind of quiet period after the event, or a deviated gaze, or were they fussy or irritable after this event? And then questions about recent history, like was there a recent illness or a recent change in formula or feeding? Has there been coughing, vomiting, diarrhea? Have there been any injuries that may or may not explain bruises that you see on the child? Past medical history is always important. We're talking about gestational age. We're talking about birth history. We're talking about newborn screening. We're talking about screening for mom at the time of delivery. We're talking about growth patterns and developmental history. And of course, previous hospitalizations and immunizations. Family history becomes important because we're asking about sudden unexplained death in the first or second degree family member before age 35. which is a big blanket, it seems like, when you're talking about an infant. So we're not talking about just child death. That's very important if there was an infant death in a first or second degree family member, but all the way up to age 35. Is there a history of long QT syndrome or arrhythmias or inborn errors of metabolism that the parent's aware of? Environmental history, what's their housing scenario? Has there been water damage or mold, or in general, where are they living? What's the environment they're living in? Is there a lot of smoke or other toxic substances they might have been exposed to, drug use in the house? Social history becomes important as well. Things like who lives in the home? What are they exposed to in the home? Have there been recent illnesses or other family members who were ill, especially with things like pertussis, you know, persistent cough in an older sibling for a while? Has there been a need for assistance services at home recently? Was there any involvement with child protective services recently for this patient or for any other person in the home? And what's the exposure of the child to adults with a history of mental illness or substance abuse? All of these are relevant to your questioning for the potential of a Brewey. And it's an outstanding table. It's all listed there for you on page 5. And I highly recommend you keep it in your pocket, as TR said. Physical examination, you're looking for specifically signs of trauma, cardiopulmonary abnormalities, and any item that might point to an explanation for the episode. So by definition, this should be a completely normal examination, but you're going to start with vital signs. You're going to make sure the child's awake and alert and at their normal baseline. You're going to look for signs of trauma. You can even use the 10-4 faces P mnemonic that is listed here in figure 1, which tells you to look at the 10 is torso, ears, and neck. The faces is the frenulum, angle of the jaw, cheeks, eyelids, and subconjunctival areas for signs of trauma. The 4 is for 4 months and younger. You're looking for any bruises anywhere. And the P is for patterned bruising, things that fit a slap or a grab or loops from wire or rope. Those are all potential signs of child abuse that are important to note on physical examination. And then when you're done with your physical examination, we move on to risk stratification. And so this is where the rubber hits the road, the low-risk patient versus the non-low-risk patient. Low-risk patients, as we mentioned before, have to be more than 60 days, greater than 32 weeks gestational age, and 45 weeks post-conceptional age, have no history of a prior Brewey, have an event duration less than a minute, and have no CPR by a trained provider. And if they meet all of these, they become low risk. Infants who don't meet these criteria fall into this kind of mixed group of high risk patients. And the AAP really hasn't focused on recommending anything in this group specifically, because there's just not a lot of good evidence for them. In the time since the publication of the AAP guidelines, which was in 2016, there have been some more studies, even on the high risk population. Brand et al. Performed a meta-analysis that showed that the risk of death in infants who experienced a Brewey is about the same as the baseline risk of death in general for infants in the first year of life, which is reassuring to us that we're headed down the right pathway and identifying correctly the low-risk population. And Tier et al. Took a closer look at the accuracy of the risk criteria, and this was all retrospective in a cohort analysis, and found that the risk criteria indeed accurately defined who was low risk. And they found that the AAP criteria had a negative predictive value of 90% and a positive predictive value of 23%. A separate study found that the AAP's risk criteria predicted a serious diagnosis with 95% sensitivity and 8% specificity. And the difference in those numbers is actually reassuring. That means that the high negative predictive value and sensitivity of these criteria reliably identifies the population that is indeed low risk, and the low positive predictive value and specificity numbers suggest that more analysis is needed for those who are in the higher risk category. So what does that mean to us in the ED? That means if they're low risk, we can, with lots of reassurance, say, yeah, this person's low risk and very unlikely to have any problems in follow-up care and very unlikely to need any further testing. But if they're high risk, we can even tell family members, hey, they're high risk, we're putting them in the hospital, but I don't want you to get alarmed by the term high risk, because most of those children do very, very well. And in a lot of them, we don't figure out what happened. And it doesn't mean that your child is going to die. And it doesn't mean we're putting them in the hospital because they're critically ill. It just means that they don't meet these super low risk criteria and we can't send you directly home. So we just have to do some more testing. I think that's the better way to approach it, or to couch it with the parents.
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway from most of this, like the more studies and everything else I had, was just the language, especially as we get into table five, which is them basically describing what they thought were the things that you should do, may do, or should not do. And I think that that really is now how I'm thinking about these cases, is how do I approach it in terms of what do I describe to the parents? What language do I use? And then what things am I trying to do versus what things am I trying to explain is going to happen.
Yeah, that's a great segue into management. There have been studies published since the AAP guidelines. Again, populations up to 2,000 patients in multiple hospitals, 15 hospitals in this 2023 trial by Mittal et al., which was a secondary analysis of a multi-center retrospective cohort. And only 3% of patients had laboratory imaging or ancillary testing that supported any kind of final diagnosis, which, again, is just reassurance that the initial guidelines written in 2016 can be relied upon. And I like the way that the AAP broke this down. There are some things that are definite no's, and there are some things that are may's. There are no musts, really, as far as must do. And I find that to be very helpful. Things on table five that were strong negatives, things you should not do in the assessment of low-risk BRUIs. So these are people who meet the criteria, have a reassuring examination, and are low risk. You don't need imaging. You don't need x-rays, chest x-rays. You don't need CT head, MRI, ultrasound. You don't need any imaging. You don't need VBGs or ABGs. You don't need overnight polysomnograph testing. You don't need echoes. You don't need cardiac or respiratory monitoring. You don't need an EEG. You should not start anti-epileptic medications. And in the ED, you don't need a white blood cell count. You don't need a blood cultures. You don't need an LP or CSF analysis. You don't need investigation for GERD. Like a lot of times people will order GI series, pH probes, endoscopies, barium contrast studies. You don't need any of that. You don't need to start acid suppression therapy. It's not recommended for a brief resolved unexplained episode that's low risk. You don't need to obtain measurements for electrolytes. You don't need that BNP or that CMP. You don't need urine, and you don't need to look for anemias. So all of those screening labs that you would think about ordering in any other patient in the ED setting, or that imaging, you don't need any of those for someone who's low risk. There are some need nots, meaning that you don't have to do these. There's very weak evidence that these are supported, but they didn't go as far as saying don't do it. And those are things like hospitalization solely for cardiorespiratory monitoring. So if they actually meet all the low risk criteria, that's a need not. So they didn't go as far as saying you absolutely shouldn't, but need not. You don't need to get a urinalysis. You don't need to do viral testing. So you're not going to blanket routinely test them for anything. You don't need to do the serum lactate acid, and you don't need to obtain blood glucose even, which surprised me, honestly, because that's something I think that the EMS colleagues are going to do anyway at the scene. I was surprised to see that on the list, but in a well-appearing infant who meets these criteria, you don't even have to get a blood glucose. Now, the evidence for that is not all that great, which is why it fits into these kind of weak negative statements. But nevertheless, it's there if you need it.
I think that was my takeaway, was if this is a low-risk BRUI, I'm going to put them on the monitor for a little bit. I'm going to make sure I get a great history and a great physical, and I really go through and carefully comb through to make sure this really is a BRUI, or that I don't think that it is or it isn't. Then I'm going to decide if they're low-risk or high-risk, and then I'm going to get an EKG. And I'm going to basically think about a glucose, because I think that recommendation I felt was weak enough that if there's any concern, I was going to get a glucose. We don't have the ability to rapidly test for pertussis, but it's something that I'm going to start looking into, because I think in the age of more and more PCR viral panels coming out, if that becomes an option, it's going to be something that I'm more interested in exploring if I have that option, especially with this patient population.
Yeah, rapid pertussis testing would actually be very helpful, I think, even if it's just this case. The weak may, like meaning you may get these, includes those three things you just mentioned. So pulse oximetry and serial observation for a couple of hours in the ED, getting that 12 lead EKG and getting a pertussis test. Those are mays. You don't have to, but you may. You should do four things. You should obtain an assessment for social risk factors to look for child abuse, which is part of your exam anyway, but you're going to ask those questions and make sure that this is not a case of child abuse to the best of your ability. You should offer resources for CPR training for the parents. You should educate caregivers about BRUI, which of course you're going to be doing as part of your explanation with parents. And you should use shared decision-making with caregivers. Now, this, I think, is where the rubber hits the road. So when you're talking to a parent about Bruise, pulling up guidelines in this scenario, for some parents, I think, would actually be helpful in showing them, hey, these are the listed guidelines for a low-risk infant, and your child meets all of them. This is what the American Academy of Pediatrics defines as a Bruise, and your child matches this episode. Make sure we're all in agreement on that. And this is what they recommend. We don't have to put them in the hospital. They can go home. I'm going to call your pediatrician. We're going to set you up with follow-up tomorrow or whenever they can see you in a quick turnaround time. And there is nothing in the guidelines or in the evidence that says that your child is at high risk and it's okay for them to go home. And now is your time to ask those questions and to talk to me about your concerns. That shared decision-making here is very, very important. And honestly, this is going to be a lengthy conversation. You may save yourself a lot of time and effort in the testing portion of this, but you are not going to save it in the disposition portion because you're just going to spend a lot of time talking with the family about why this person is low risk and why they're okay to go home and doing a lot of reassurance. And that's okay. I don't want you to mistake negative testing as the reason why we're sending your child home because we're not going to really do much testing. And I don't want you to think that if we put your child in the hospital, that would be better for them. And I don't want you to think that I'm intentionally not putting them in the hospital. There are guidelines for this decision-making. So it's a delicate conversation, but a very important one.
I think I would only add one thing to that because I thought that you characterized that beautifully and I think hit on how important it is to communicate with everybody. Like you said, pediatrician, family, other family members that might be pressuring the family about things. I always ask if families want me to talk to somebody else. But I think the last thing I would want to point out is they've shown that home monitoring, like some of the home baby monitoring systems have so many false positives that it just leads to more ER visits and they recommend against home monitoring. But I would tell you that if you have a baby camera system to watch your baby, I'm kind of interested in that because I would tell you that it gives us an objective thing to look at that if this happens again or anything else, I think that I would want parents to know, hey, if this happens again, make sure you know what the time it was. And if it can be on the video or you can bring the video with you, that's, I think, an important piece to add because it gives you an objective thing to look at as opposed to so much of the subjective aspect of this.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I don't know that there's any evidence behind baby cam video yet, but that might be a good thing to study if you could get a big enough population and enough video footage. The standard home monitoring right now is things like apnea monitors, which is keeping a track of a, you know, typically a one lead EKG and a sat monitor that will alarm at home. And I'll just tell you from my experience with parents who have children on home apnea monitors, it is a huge anxiety provoking step. Most people think, oh, okay, I'm going to be reassured if I bring my child home and they have this monitor. The problem is, the monitors are placed on really tiny fingers or really tiny toes. They're notoriously poor at trying to get that signal. And yeah, you get a lot of false alarms. And you think about us working in the ED, how many false alarms and the alarm fatigue that we get. When you translate that to the home environment where you're trying to get your sleep overnight and this thing keeps beeping and alarming. And it's not just as simple as, oh, get up and turn it off. It's every time it alarms, you're in a 911 scenario. You know, you're thinking your child's dying, jumping up and racing to the room. And then to discover that it's a false alarm, by the time you get back to bed and try and get some sleep, you've already lost like half the night at that point, if you're able to get back to sleep at all. And it can be a hugely obtrusive thing for parents and the home. And so I think that's the reason why it's just not been shown to help very much. And the cardiopulmonary assessment, actually, for what you do with these patients, there was a study of 2,036 patients meeting criteria with no new cardiac diagnosis identified during the index visit, which supported even the AAP's recommendations that you don't even have to get an ECG in this scenario, much less do invasive or continuous cardiac monitoring, because it just doesn't yield what we want it to yield, and it ends up just causing delays or worse, interfering with their life at home. The non-accidental trauma is an important thing to mention only because as soon as you identify that this patient may have non-accidental trauma, they're no longer in the Bruise category. So we talk about you don't need imaging, you don't need x-rays, you don't need CT, you don't need MRI, you don't need. But if they are in the category of non-accidental trauma, none of that applies. You need to go on and do your skeletal survey, and you need to do your neuroimaging, and you need to do all the things that you're supposed to do for non-accidental trauma. Do not follow BRUI guidelines if you think they have non-accidental trauma. That's a very, very important distinction.
And I think, like you said, the big takeaway from this today is, are they a BRUI or are they not? Because if they're not, even if it sounds like a BRUI or an ALT, we're so used to that, like, well, it went limp, there was this episode, they changed color. If you've got something else, you've got to break that in your brain that they're not a BRUI, and now you need to treat them as that other thing and don't even consider this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think we all come to this kind of scenario with some kind of bias. You know, either it's the, I'm going to be responsible for admitting them and I just don't want to do it, or I have to call the pediatrician now and see if I can push them into admitting them and I don't want to do it, or worse, I work in the critical care unit and I think everybody has something that we haven't identified and we need to put them in, or this is a family member and I want to really make sure they get the best care and that means they have to be in and they have to be on a monitor, et cetera. So whatever your bias is, you got to just admit and be aware of it as you're walking into this scenario and try and be as objective as possible, which I think the AAP did a really good job in trying to make this an objective process so that we have all of this evidence to help guide us. There is a lower and a higher risk category for the people who don't meet the low risk. So now, if you meet the low risk we've talked about, you don't need to do anything, reassurance, maybe watch them a little bit in the ED and then send them home, have them follow up. What about the high risk people, the people who are not low risk? There has been evidence published since those 2016 guidelines that there may actually be a group of patients who don't meet low risk criteria, but maybe don't need all of that testing. What should you do with them? What's their actual risk? And there have been some good studies published. One, Nama et al. Found that in contrast to the criteria used by the AAP, perhaps there's three populations, kind of a low and a medium and a high risk group of patients. And Teeter et al. Found that about 87% of patients who present to the ED didn't meet the low risk category. They had at least one precluding item. So there's a large population of people who are going to be deemed not low risk, and only about 13% in his study actually met the low risk guidelines. But the same study found that despite that, revisits or repeat visits to the emergency department only occurred in about 6.9% of discharged patients and 10% of hospital discharged patients. So we're doing a good job in that sense that people aren't continuously coming back. We're not missing a whole bunch of diagnosis. And serious diagnoses were only made in about 4% of cases. So even though 87% of the patients aren't going to meet low-risk criteria, only 4% of cases actually do come out with a serious diagnosis. And that just leaves a lot of fodder for continuing research, because we're not sure yet how to exclude or tease out those moderate-risk patients. There is a tool, the Brief Resolved Unexplained Events 2.0 calculator, actually on MDCalc, which is from that Naaman study, that helps guide you with some of those risk factors. You might be able to come up with a number and a risk factor. There are also some examination features of high-risk diagnoses and possible evaluations. So for the population of patients you're going to put in the hospital, depending on the reason why they fell out of the low-risk category, there are some things that might guide you in what further testing you need. Not everybody needs an MRI of their whole body and a stay in the ICU. You might be able to tailor it to what the abnormality was that caused them to fall out of the low-risk category. So Table 6 there discusses things like if they had tachycardia, bradycardia, or an irregular rhythm, maybe cardiac disease is the top of the list. You're getting your ECG, maybe an echo, and maybe a cardiology consult. If it's a breathing issue like tachypnea or stridor or abnormal breath sounds, they've got a pulmonary issue, then maybe they just need prolonged continuous monitoring and a sleep study, maybe a chest x-ray. If it's a non-accidental trauma, then you've got to go down that pathway. If they're altered or have abnormal tone, or have an abnormal neuro exam, then you're looking at things like MRI imaging, EEGs, and a neuro consult. So there are, depending on what you find, some things that you can do in the inpatient realm to help exclude those diagnoses.
And I think this is the kind of thing that I try to teach students, where I try to tell them, if you can go a step or two beyond where you would have before you call that consultant, before you call that pediatrician, and you say, hey, I think they're a BRUI, and I think they're high risk based on X, Y, and Z, and looking at their exam and everything, I'm more worried about tone and feeding as the issues here. So I think this needs to go more of a GI neuro route for the workup. What do you think? that's a much easier question to bring to your consultant because they can see what they could do for the patient instead of just having to start from scratch. And I feel like you're going to have more pleasant conversations with your pediatricians when you try to admit these kids, if that's the way that you couch your patient presentations.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So five things that will change your practice. I think this is a good summary for our emergency medicine colleagues listening. When you're evaluating somebody for a BRUI, apply the AAP criteria to determine if they're low risk. If they are low risk, the only diagnostic testing recommended, again, that's a weak recommendation, so you may do these, would be an ECG and pertussis testing. Number two, there is no need to admit low-risk BRUI patients to the hospital. Number three, you can consider monitoring them briefly in the ED for 1 to 4 hours. Number four, even for low-risk patients, a thorough history, physical, and assessment of the social factors to detect non-accidental trauma is essential. So that's obviously part of that evaluation. And number five, there is some evidence that a new tiered approach to the higher-risk infants can be relied on, and that quickly identifying some of those conditions for which a delayed diagnosis or treatment might impact outcomes can help guide you in what your next steps are going to be to try and tailor that inpatient workup or that observation workup to the appropriate diagnostic testing. And that's basically all those things in table six, depending on what it is that dropped them out of the low risk category. So there's five things that will impact your practice tomorrow when you see this patient in the ED. I think that Dr. Austin Page and Dr. Cho did an outstanding job with this article. There has been a good volume of evidence supporting those 2016 guidelines, and there's been evidence since then trying to tease out the people who fell out of the low-risk category, and I'm looking forward to seeing more in this realm, especially for that category of patients who don't meet the low risk, and then what do you do with them? I think there's good studies coming to answer those questions. And thank you to both of those authors for authoring this article. This is, again, the April 2024 Pediatric Emergency Medicine Practice on BRUIs, Evaluation and Management in the Emergency Department.
Check out that calculator on MDCalc. If nothing else, that'll really help you with these.
Awesome. All right, everybody. Until next time.
Good luck out there.
Well, that's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Amplify. Don't forget to rate us in whatever podcast store you listen. We sincerely appreciate your feedback. And of course, don't forget ebmedicine.net, your one-stop shop for all of your CME needs and all of those wonderful services, including the resources that you can use while on shift in the emergency department or the urgent care. ebmedicine.net. Until next time, be safe, everyone.